Chapter 34. Making them seem to arise naturally out of the suggestion of our talk, I totally failed to arrive at any distinct conclusion. I was afraid to put the direct question. Do you not share the common feeling of interest in criminal stories? This question would doubtless have elicited a categorical reply, but somehow, the consciousness of an arrière-pensée made me shrink from putting such a question. Reflecting on this indifference on a special point, and on the numerous manifestations I had noticed of his sensibility, I came at last to the conclusion that he must be a man of tender heart, whose delicate sensibilities easily shrank from the horrible under every form, and no more permitted him to dwell unnecessarily upon painful facts than they permit imaginative minds to dwell on the details of an operation. I had not long settled this in my mind before an accident suddenly threw a lurid light upon many details noticed previously, and painfully revived that inexplicable repulsion with which I had at first regarded him. A new suspicion filled my mind, or rather, let me say, a distinct shape was impressed upon many fluctuating suspicions. It scarcely admitted of argument, and at times seemed preposterous, nevertheless it persisted. The mind which in broad daylight assents to all that can be alleged against the absurdities of the belief in apparitions, will often acknowledge the dim terrors of darkness and loneliness, terrors at possibilities of supernatural visitations. In like manner, in the clear daylight of reason I could see the absurdity of my suspicion, but the vague stirrings of feeling remained unsilenced. I was haunted by the dim horrors of a possibility. Thus it arose. We were both going to Munich, and Bergenhoff had shortened his contemplated stay at Nuremberg, that he might have the pleasure of accompanying me, adding also that he too, should be glad to reach Munich, not only for its art, but for its greater command of papers and intelligence respecting what was then going on in France. On the night preceding the morning of our departure, I was seated in his room, smoking, and discussing as usual, while Ivan, his servant, packed up his things in two large portmanteaus. Ivan was a serf who spoke no word of any language but his own. Although of a brutal, almost idiotic type, he was loudly eulogized by his master as the model of fidelity and usefulness. Bergenhoff treated him with gentleness, though with a certain imperiousness, much as one might treat a savage mastiff which it was necessary to dominate without exasperating. He more than once spoke of Ivan as a living satire on physiognomists and phrenologists, and as I am a phrenologist, I listened with some incredulity. "Look at him," he would say. "Observe the low, retreating brow, the flat face, the surly mouth, the broad base of the head, and the huge bull-like neck." Would not anyone say Ivan was as destructive as a panther, as tenacious as a bulldog, as brutal as a bull? Yet he is the gentlest of sluggish creatures, and as tender-hearted as a girl. That thick-set muscular frame shrouds a hare's heart. He is so faithful, and so attached, that I believe for me, he would risk his life. But on no account could you get him to place himself in danger on his own account. Part of his love for me is gratitude for having rescued him from the conscription. The dangers incident to a military life had no charm for him. Now, although Bergenhoff, who was not a phrenologist, might be convinced of the absence of ferocious instincts in Ivan, to me, as a phrenologist, the statement was eminently incredible. All the appearances of his manner were such as to confirm his master's opinion. He was quiet, even tender in his attentions. But the tyrannous influence of ideas and physical impressions cannot be set aside, and no evidence would permanently have kept down my distrust of this man. When women shriek at the sight of a gun, it is in vain that you solemnly assure them that the gun is not loaded. "I don't know," they reply, "at any rate, I don't like it." I was much in this attitude with regard to Ivan. He might be harmless. I didn't know that. What I did know was that I didn't like his looks. On this night he was moving noiselessly about the room, employed in packing. Bergenhoff's talk rambled over the old themes, and I thought I had never before met with one of my own age whose society was so perfectly delightful. He was not so conspicuously my superior on all points, that I felt the restraints inevitably imposed by superiority. Yet he was in many respects sufficiently above me in knowledge and power, to make me eager to have his assent to my views where we differed, and to have him enlighten me, where I knew myself to be weak. In the very moment of my most cordial admiration came a shock. Ivan, on passing from one part of the room to the other, caught his foot in the strap of the portmanteau and fell. The small wooden box, something of a glove box, which he held in his hand at the time, fell on the floor, and falling over, discharged its contents close to Berganov's feet. The objects which caught my eyes were several pairs of gloves, a rouge pot and hare's foot, and a black beard. By what caprice of imagination was it, that the sight of this false beard lying at Berganov's feet thrilled me with horror? In one lightning flash I beheld the archway, the stranger with the startled eyes, this stranger no longer unknown to me, but too fatally recognized as Berganov, and at his feet the murdered girl. Moved by what subtle springs of suggestion I know not, but there before me stood that dreadful vision, seen in a lurid light, but seen as clearly as if the actual presence of the objects were obtruding itself upon my eyes. In the inexpressible horror of this vision my heart seemed clutched with an icy hand. Fortunately Berganov's attention was called away from me. He spoke angrily some short sentence, which of course was in Russian, and therefore unintelligible to me. He then stooped, and picking up the rouge pot, held it towards me with his melancholy smile. He was very red in the face, but that may have been either anger, or the effect of sudden stooping. "I see you are surprised at these masquerading follies," he said in a tone which, though low, was perfectly calm. "You must not suppose that I beautify my sallow cheeks on ordinary occasions." He then quietly handed the pot to Ivan, who replaced it with the gloves and the beard in the box, and after making an inquiry which sounded like a growl, to which Berganov answered negatively, he continued his packing. Berganov resumed his cigar and his argument, as if nothing had happened. The vision had disappeared, but a confused mass of moving figures took its place. My heart throbbed so violently, that it seemed to me, as if its tumult must be heard by others. Yet my face must have been tolerably calm, since Berganov made no comment on it. I answered his remarks in vague fragments, for, in truth, my thoughts were flying from conjecture to conjecture. I remembered that the stranger had a florid complexion. Was this rouge? It is true that I fancied the stranger carried a walking stick in his right hand. If so, this was enough to crush all suspicions of his identity with Berganov. But then I was rather hazy on this point, and probably did not observe a walking stick. After a while my inattention struck him, and looking at me with some concern, he inquired if there was anything the matter. I pleaded a colic, which I attributed to the imprudence of having indulged in sauerkraut at dinner. He advised me to take a little brandy, but, affecting a fresh access of pain, I bade him good night. He hoped I should be all right on the morrow. If not, he added, we can postpone our journey till the day after. Once in my own room I bolted the door, and sat down on the edge of the bed in a tumult of excitement. The fluctuations, alone with my thoughts, and capable of pursuing conjectures and conclusions without external interruption, I quickly exhausted all the hypothetical possibilities of the case, and, from having started with the idea that Berganov was the assassin, I came at last to the more sensible conclusion that I was a constructive blockhead. My suspicions were simply outrageous in their defect of evidence, and could never for one moment have seemed otherwise to any imagination less riotously active than mine. I bathed my heated head, undressed myself, and got into bed, considering what I should say to the police when I went next morning to communicate my suspicions. and it is worthy of remark, as well as somewhat ludicrously self-betraying, that no sooner did I mentally see myself in the presence of the police, and was thus forced to confront my suspicions with some appearance of evidence, than the whole fabric of my vision rattled to the ground. What had I to say to the police? Simply that, on the evening of the night when Lieschen was murdered, I had passed in a public thoroughfare a man whom I could not identify, but who, as I could not help fancying, seemed to recognize me. This man, I had persuaded myself, was the murderer, for which persuasion I was unable to adduce a tittle of evidence. It was uncolored by the remotest possibility. It was truly and simply the suggestion of my vagrant fancy, which had mysteriously settled itself into a conviction, and having thus capriciously identified the stranger with Lieschen's murderer, I now, upon evidence quite as preposterous, identified Burganoff with the stranger. The folly became apparent even to myself. If Burganoff had in his possession a rouge pot and false beard, I could not but acknowledge that he made no attempt to conceal them, nor had he manifested any confusion on their appearance. He had quietly characterized them as masquerading follies. Moreover, I now began to remember distinctly that the stranger did carry a walking stick in his right hand, and as Burganoff had lost his right arm, that settled the point. Into such complications would the tricks of imagination lead me. I blushed mentally, and resolved to let it serve as a lesson in future. It is needless, however, to say that the lesson was lost, as such lessons always are lost. A strong tendency in any direction soon disregards all the teachings of experience. I am still not the less the victim of my constructive imagination, because I have frequently had to be ashamed of its vagaries. The next morning I awoke with a lighter breast, rejoicing in the caution which had delayed me from any rash manifestation of suspicions now seen to be absurd. I smiled as the thought arose. What if this suspected stranger should also be pestered by an active imagination, and should entertain similar suspicions of me? He must have seen in my eyes the look of recognition which I saw in his. On hearing of the murder, our meeting may also have recurred to him, and his suspicions would have this color, wanting to mine, that I happen to inherit with my Italian blood a somewhat truculent appearance, which has gained for me among my friends the playful sobriquet of the brigand. Anxious to atone at once for my folly, and to remove from my mind any misgiving, if it existed at my quitting him so soon after the disclosures of the masquerading details, I went to Burganoff, as soon as I was dressed, and proposed a ramble till the diligence started for Munich. He was sympathetic in his inquiries about my colic, which I assured him had quite passed away, and out we went. The sharp morning air of March made us walk briskly, and gave a pleasant animation to our thoughts. As he discussed the acts of the provisional government, so wise, temperate, and energetic, the fervor and generosity of his sentiments stood out in such striking contrast with the deed I had last night recklessly imputed to him, that I felt deeply ashamed, and was nearly carried away by mingled admiration and self-reproach to confess the absurd vagrancy of my thoughts and humbly ask his pardon. But you can understand the reluctance at a confession, so insulting to him, so degrading to me. It is at all times difficult to tell a man, face to face, eye to eye, the evil you have thought of him, unless the recklessness of anger seizes on it as a weapon with which to strike, and I had now so completely unsaid to myself all that I once had thought of evil, that to put it in words seemed a gratuitous injury to me, and insult to him. A day or two after our arrival in Munich, a reaction began steadily to set in. Ashamed as I was of my suspicions, I could not altogether banish from my mind the incident which had awakened them. The image of that false beard would mingle with my thoughts. I was vaguely uncomfortable at the idea of Burganoff's carrying about with him obvious materials of disguise. In itself this would have had little significance. But coupled with the fact that his devoted servant was, in spite of all Burganoff's eulogies, repulsively ferocious in aspect, capable, as I could not help believing, of any brutality. The suggestion was unpleasant. You will understand that having emphatically acquitted Berganoff in my mind, I did not again distinctly charge him with any complicity in the mysterious murder. On the contrary, I should indignantly have repelled such a thought, but the uneasy sense of some mystery about him, coupled with the accessories of disguise, and the aspect of the servant, gave rise to dim, shadowy forebodings which ever and anon passed across my mind. Did it ever occur to you, reader, to reflect on the depths of deceit which lie still, and dark even in the honestest minds? Society reposes on a thin crust of convention, underneath which lie fathomless possibilities of crime, and consequently suspicions of crime. Friendship, however close and dear, is not free from its reserves, unspoken beliefs, more or less suppressed opinions. The man whom you would indignantly defend against any accusation brought by another, so confident are you in his unshakable integrity, you may yourself momentarily suspect of crimes far exceeding those which you repudiate. Indeed, I have known sagacious men hold that perfect frankness in expressing the thoughts is a sure sign of imperfect friendship. Something is always suppressed. And it is not he who loves you that tells you candidly what he thinks of your person, your pretensions, your children, or your poems. Perfect candor is dictated by envy, or some other unfriendly feeling, making friendship a stalking horse, under cover of which it shoots the arrow which will rankle. Friendship is candid only when the candor is urgent, meant to avert impending danger, or to rectify an error. The candor which is an impertinence never springs from friendship. Love is sympathetic. I do not, of course, mean to intimate that my feeling for Berganoff was of that deep kind which justifies the name of friendship. I only want to say that in our social relations we are constantly hiding from each other, under the smiles and courtesies of friendly interest, thoughts which, if expressed, would destroy all possible communion, and that, nevertheless, we are not insincere in our smiles and courtesies. And therefore there is nothing paradoxical in my having felt great admiration for Berganoff, and great pleasure in his society, while all the time there was deep down in the recesses of my thoughts an uneasy sense of a dark mystery which possibly connected him with a dreadful crime. This feeling was roused into greater activity by an incident which now occurred. One morning I went to Berganoff's room, which was at some distance from mine on the same floor, intending to propose a visit to the sculpture at the Glyptothek. To my surprise I found Ivan the serf standing before the closed door. He looked at me like a mastiff about to spring, and intimated by significant gestures that I was not allowed to enter the room. Concluding that his master was occupied in some way, and desired not to be disturbed, I merely signified by a nod that my visit was of no consequence, and went out. On returning about an hour afterwards I saw Ivan putting three pink letters into the letterbox of the hotel. I attached no significance to this very ordinary fact at the time, but went up to my room, and began writing my letters, one of which was to my lawyer, sending him an important receipt. The dinner bell sounded, before I had half finished this letter, but I wrote on, determined to have done with it at once, in case the afternoon should offer any expedition with Berganoff. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.